This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at weepa.org. Here's your host, Mike Causey.
Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us. My guest today is Arthur Stein, very popular with listeners, and he's a financial advisor in the Washington area. Many of his clients are federal employees, former feds, or retirees, and I think he counts several thrift savings plan millionaires among his crew. So, Art, welcome to the show.
Mike, thank you for having me.
Good day. We had some technical difficulties earlier here, and you almost got the Bugs Bunny hour out of the sound, but we survived it. Listen, I appreciate the column you wrote this morning, or the guest column you wrote, sort of taking us through it. The TSP, the thrift savings plan, and the stock market in general have been doing wonderfully well, with some exceptions, and that's kind of what we're here to talk about today. One of the characteristics of the TSP millionaire, there are now 98,000 of them. They've been investing for an average of 29 years, and investing largely or entirely in the C, S, and the I funds, the stock funds. And particularly the ones who did not leave the stock market during the Great Recession. A number of people, as you well know, bailed out and said they were going to go into the G fund, the Treasury Securities Fund, until it was safe to come back into the stock market. And that safety began in 2009, and yet there are still some people who have not returned. They're waiting for the right moment. Do you find this with your clients?
Yeah, many of the people that come to me, when they come to me, have been in that situation where they became too conservative way too early, and then, of course, never got back in. And the problem with getting back in, and it's interesting, Mike, I just had this conversation with someone yesterday who 5 years ago, a friend said that the market was going to crash and he should go into bonds. And so he put everything into the F fund, not the G fund. That was a little bit unusual.
Yeah.
And the problem that he then ran into is he took the money out of the stock funds.
Yeah.
Because his friend told him the market was too high, but then the market went up and, then it becomes so hard to get back in, because if you thought the market was too high when you got out of it and then it goes up, Well then it's even higher than when you thought it was too high. So he never went back in, and I did a rough calculation that had he gone back in, he would have about twice as much in his TSP as he does have. Huge difference.
This is such a psychological game that I think many people would say this is why it's important to have a financial planner, an advisor who's putting you first and wants to do the best by you, and this is the kind of thing where somebody can call you or you can call them and you can sort of talk them off the ledge.
Yes, exactly. And with the person I spoke to yesterday, so this friend of his said get out, and he did. And I didn't ask him, but I wondered if they were still friends.
Yeah, yeah.
It cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, and that's the thing, too. These people are ordinary people. They may be brilliant at their jobs or whatnot, but they're not psychics. They can't – to tell you that the market is too high is absurd. I get something called the Wilshire Index, and it's a daily – photograph of the stock market, and I think it would behoove everybody in America to get it and see it every day, because one day there'll be and they do use the term paper loss, but they'll say the market was up, it was a paper gain of $26 million, next day the market was down and there's a loss, and if you follow these it would be heart stopping.
Yeah, and it is for people, and we even had sort of a mini example the last 4 or 5 days.
Yes.
On Monday, the market was down, you know, depending on which index you're looking at, but about 1.6% for the S&P 500, and even more than that for some other indexes. And actually for the TSPC fund over from last Thursday through the close of business Monday, C fund was down 2.6%. So, you know, I mean, it's close to a 3% drop. And there are a lot of articles in the paper, you know, people, is this not the end of the world, but it's a big drop and what's going on? And is this COVID causing, because of the resurgence of the, of COVID because of this variant D or whatever it's
Delta
called.
Delta variant, yeah.
You know, is the market going to have a big crash? But then yesterday it was up enough so that the C fund was at the same share price level that it was on Thursday. Well, so, you know, if you did nothing, nothing happened.
Nothing happened, yeah. Yeah, which is often the case. Last month when you were on the show, we were doing this, and the market had hit record highs. I think it was June 30th when it hit a record high. And then, as you said, there were those few days there of worry. I'm looking at the front page of the New York Times for July 20th. Stocks tumble as virus fears revisit Wall Street. Worst day in months, muddies recovery. And then you go on and down and read it, and it is about the Delta variant and new cases, and people are becoming nervous. And then a day later, it's all good again, at least for the day.
Yeah. And, you know, if we look at the CNS and the I funds, and the data I have is through July 19th, so that was Monday, but close of business. I mean, the three stock funds are negative since the beginning of July.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look since the beginning of the year, they have very strong positive gains. C funds up 14%. With the bond fund, the F fund, it was up. It's up 1.2% since July 1st, but it's down for the year 0.3%. Well, it's just, if you look at these short time periods or react to these short term fluctuations, I mean, you're just always going to be in trouble. And I'm not minimizing in any way the risks that come with investing in the stock market. It is extremely volatile, and it can be negative for, you know, long periods of time. And, you know, individual stocks, of course, you know, can be very risky because a company could go bankrupt. But for people in the TSP, they're investing in indexes. The S&P 500, the C fund invests in 500 different companies, and the S fund, I mean, thousands of companies. And the I fund, I'm not quite sure, but not as many certainly as the S fund. Well, and so your risk is spread out over a large number of companies, and it's a long-term investment. It's not a short-term investment.
Yeah, this day trading is terrifying.
Yeah, you know, people who day trade, and what we mean by that, Mike, is that a day trader is someone who will, like, buy something in the morning and then sell it in the afternoon or vice versa, hoping to make a small amount of money on things that happen during the day. And a day trader might think that he or she sees patterns that can be taken advantage of over, you know, a very short period of time. And they're just, you know, the number of successful day traders over long periods of time is approaching zero. And one of the reasons is the expenses of doing all the trades and the taxes, if you're in a taxable account. Now, the TSP was, you know, very aware of people who were trying to not day trade, but move in and out of the TSP in anticipation of moves and trying to use it as a more speculative investment vehicle. And that's why, you know, some time ago, they put limits on what are called inter-fund transfers. And that's the number of times per month that you can move money from one fund to another. And the limit is twice. with this exception, you can always move money into the G fund from any of the other security, from any of the other TSP funds, as many as you like, as many times as you want during the month.
Okay.
That's just into the G fund. But if you want to go from like F to C and then back from C to F, you can only do that kind of trade twice in a month.
Okay. I want to ask you more about that after the break here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Arthur Stein, a financial planner in the Washington area. Now, Arthur, how can people reach you?
Okay, so my website is arthursteinfinancial.com. That's A-R-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-I-N, financial.com. My email is art@arthursteinfinancial.com. And if you do get on my website, you can sign up to be on my email list, which means you won't get a lot of emails.
Okay.
But I do a monthly newsletter, and then, you know, I'll send out a notice, for instance, that I was on the Mike Causey show, and provide a link to listen to the recording and notice when I blog about topics of interest to federal employees and retirees. I will send an email notice of that.
Okay. And you've been teaching courses in the Thrift Savings Plan at Montgomery College over the past couple of years, haven't you?
Well, not, you know, actually, Mike, that when COVID hit and they went to webinars, I found, you know, I did some webinars for Montgomery College and I did some webinars on my own. And I decided that I didn't like webinars.
Okay. Much. Many don't. Yeah.
And so I have done webinars on investing in the TSP and am going to do it again in the fall, but I don't haven't taught for Montgomery College in well, about 18 months.
Okay, well, maybe this will get them on the stick. We'll see here.
Yeah.
Hey, I think you covered part of this earlier in the show, but there's a question from Denise in Chicago, and she says, I know you can't invest money in the TSP after you retire, but can you still reallocate your TSP investments after you retire? If yes,
yeah.
Is there a limit to how often or how many times you can reallocate?
Yeah. So, Denise, you have the exact same ability to make transfers among the funds, i.e. reallocate, when you're retired as you do when you're working. There's no difference there. Of course, you can't put in new money unless it is a transfer from an IRA. And, but, you know, I was, or a 401k, because, you know, some people have 401ks from previous jobs.
Right.
You can still transfer those into the TSP when you're retired, but no more employee contributions, of course. And, but managing the funds does not change.
You know, that's interesting because when the TSP first started out, of course, it was people started with a zero balance when they joined up. But there were some political appointees, federal judges who had been very successful lawyers, what have you, who had a lot of money, and they brought it in. They transferred it into the TSP on their first day on the job. So you had half a dozen millionaires at the very beginning of the TSP, but none of them had earned it in the TSP. Now you have 98,000, the vast majority of whom are just ordinary folk who've been investing for a long period of time. But it's good to know those transfer rules.
Yeah, and Mike, as you said at the beginning of the show, I mean, not a scientific survey, but the TSP millionaires that you speak to and the ones that I've spoken to, basically, I mean, of course, they've been in the government for a long time, but what's really unique about them is they put the majority of their money in the stock fund, CS&I, and they kept it there. They didn't pull it out when there was a recession or a stock market crash. They didn't pull it out when President Trump was elected. And I bring that up not in a partisan way, but because a lot of people did get out of the market. And that, of course, turned out to be a very big mistake. So they were just consistent. and they were patient and didn't worry about the dips.
Well, it's interesting you'd say that, because the Wilshire 6000 index that I mentioned earlier has these key points, and it photographs them each day, and it looks at them for yesterday compared to today and yesterday compared to January 20th. And one of their benchmarks is the when Donald Trump was elected president, many people expected the markets to go down, and it didn't. And when he was inaugurated, many people expected the markets to go down, and it didn't. After he'd been in office for a time, many people expected an exodus of retirements from the government, and that did not happen. So all of these, quote, experts and pros are like the individual you knew who found out from a friend that the market was overpriced and got out. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that the stock market, when it goes up and down, it doesn't do it, you know, in even amounts over any period of time. It tends to make big moves up and big moves down. And if you miss the up moves, you know, it's very hard to make up for that. I mean, over the last year, and this through the end of June, and this was in the article, over a 12-month period, the C fund was up 41%, the S fund was up 62%, and the I fund was up 32%. Those are big moves. And if you miss them, if you pulled out in March and didn't get back in, then you miss this huge increase, and you really can't make up for that. You just kind of permanently have less money than you would have.
Yeah, and I'm
now, market can go down too, mm-hmm. and we never know when the next big decrease is going to be, but still.
Well, the people that wrote it out during the 2008-2009 recession, which in retrospect didn't last all that long, they did very well because they were buying low, dollar cost averaging, right?
Yeah, and that's another thing to keep in mind. There are two allocations you can have with the TSP. And of course, one allocation is the money that you've already invested. And that you can change by doing, you know, what are called inter-fund transfers. And that's rebalancing your TSP account or reallocating it. And as, you know, we said before, you can make two moves a month plus as many moves as you want into the G fund. But the other way you can affect your TSP account is by the allocation of the money, if you're employed, that you're putting in every 2 weeks. And those biweekly investments, the allocation can be completely different than the allocation for your current balances. So even if you feel pretty conservative and want to move some money, you know, out of the stock market, hopefully you don't do it all, you can still be very aggressive with the new money coming in. Like maybe that's all in the C and the S and the I funds. So at least you're putting in new money. And of course, if the market goes down, you're glad you're doing that because you're buying shares at a much lower price.
You know, I think many people had the same experience I did during the Great Recession. But we have a 401k here, but there's no employer match. But we still have a 401k. And during the Great Recession, even talking to people like you and just watching the news, I did nothing. I continued to buy stocks. And every quarter when I'd get my statement, it was down. Sometimes it was down even including my contribution for that year. And very disheartening. And then one day I got a statement in mid-2009. And I literally thought it was somebody else's. It had almost doubled, quote, overnight, you know, in a 3-month period.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it. You need to be patient, and it's and historically, you know, if you were patient, you saw the stock market way outperform the bond markets. I mean, one set of statistics that I think is useful. And again, this was in the article today. Is looking at the 15-year average annual rate of return for the TSP funds. And, you know, through June 30th of this year. And remember, I'm sorry, the 15-year return includes the bear market, the huge market crash we had in March of 2020, and also the even bigger one we had in 2007, 8, and 9. The C fund average 11% a year. I'm rounding off. Yep. The S fund average 11% a year. Well, the G fund was only 2.5% a year. And the bond fund did much better than that. The F fund did much better than that, but it was only 4.6% a year. So for that's, you know, a 15-year period where you have twice or four times the rate of return per year over a 15-year period, the difference in the amount of money you end up with is huge because it compounds. So it's going to be more than four times as much money.
Well, and you've made the point a number of times that the G fund at one point was a pretty good deal because interest rates were high, the inflation was high, and it was paying very well. But the year to date in the chart that you have today's in today's column is 0.6. That's not a very big return.
Yeah, and over the last 12 months, it was 1%. And that's because, you know, the return of the G fund has been declining sharply since it was introduced because interest rates have been declining. So G fund was introduced and first full year was 1988. And in 1988 and 89, the yearly return was 8.8%. Well, now we're down to 1% in calendar year 2020. And that's 89% lower. And of course, the cost of living has gone up tremendously during that time period. So if you're getting a lower rate of return and the cost of living is going up, it means the G fund, you know, the interest on a G fund investment buys, you know, less and less of what you need to maintain your life.
That's incredible to go from almost 9% to less than one.
And yeah, people and you know,
call it we safe. Went,
and that's an extreme example because 8.8% interest in 1988. I mean, that was unusually high in the United States, and interest rates now are unusually low in the United States. But one thing that's not surprising is the cost of living just keeps going up, and interest rates really don't keep up.
Well, an example is this year the people who get cost of living adjustments, the federal retirees, people under Social Security, and those getting military retired pay, they got a 1.3% increase, reflecting the rate of inflation for that previous period. Right now, in July, with 3 months to go in the countdown, they're looking at a possible raise in January 2022 of 6% or more. So things can change very quickly.
Yeah, and I've seen, you know, comments how great that would be. But actually, yeah, you know, it's designed to be neither good nor bad.
Yeah.
That if inflation's 6% and you get a 6% increase in your federal annuity, your pension, you're about even. And of course, FERS retirees,
right,
are not going to get 6%. They would only get 5%. So the purchasing power of their annuity is going to go down. High inflation is not going to put anybody ahead.
Okay. Producer Eric White says we got to take a break here, so we'll do that on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Arthur Stein, financial planner in the Washington area. And we were talking about earlier about the dangers of day trading. And Art, I remember several years ago, the day traders, they seemed to be almost organized. I think somebody figured out there were about 4,100 of them. And they, you know, they were organized and they were lobbying to be able to continue to do this. And it became almost a religious or a political thing with them.
Yeah, well, there were, it got to be very popular at one time. And I had a cousin who became a day trader, and I knew the end was near when he did. He was like the canary in the coal mine because, business doing this. Yeah, there is nothing in his background that would indicate that he would be able to do this. And, you know, listen, there are hedge funds that try and do this, and they spend tens of millions of dollars on research and systems and computers and things to try and do this successfully. And it's just not a good idea. It's not really possible. You're not going to beat the market. You're not going to beat the hedge funds. You don't know what's going to happen. No one is good at forecasting what's going to happen to stocks. And President Trump's election is a good example. By far the majority, and I'd say about 80% of the people I read who were quoted on what would happen if Donald Trump was elected president, about 80% of them, and I'm including top Wall Street people, said the market would crash. And, you know, the market, it didn't really affect the market. The market had been going up and it continued to go up. And that was it.
I remember that. And it became political, you know, and their filter wouldn't let them see what could possibly happen and what did happen.
And and then again, you know, as a investment manager and financial planner, I mean, I every year read articles about how this person who got last year's forecast right is now forecasting X. And the problem is that person, if you look back on his forecast before last year, they weren't right.
Yeah.
You know? So he or she got 1 year right, becomes a big hero. And then they don't get the next year right, or they didn't get the previous year right. There's a solid historical evidence about the stock market, and yet so many people invest as if they expect the market to go down and never come back up. And, you know, that's theoretically possible. It would be, an extremely negative view of the United States and the economy. But I mean, I'm not saying it's not possible, but if you believe that's going to happen, you really should have your money not in stocks or bonds, but in guns and canned goods and building a shelter in the basement.
Yeah. Well, it's so true. When you let politics enter into anything like this, you see it with the COVID vaccination and the vaccine deniers and all of that. And it's really very sad, in addition to being very dangerous at times. Hey, Art, for years now, they've talked about opening up the TSP and allowing people maybe a window or an option or a time frame when they could take money out of the TSP and put it into a similar vehicle, an IRA or something outside of the TSP, to give them more or different choices. Now, they've talked about it for years, and now my colleague Nicole Grisco reports that they're going to do it. The TSP, the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, is going to open up the system next year. What do you know about that?
Okay, well, I don't know a lot, but I did confirm it with the TSP that the mutual fund window, which is what it's called, has been approved, and that they expect it to be active about the middle of next year. You know, it might be late, it might not. I mean, that's not really important.
Yeah.
And what it means is that a certain amount, or maybe all of the money that someone has in the TSP, could be moved into a brokerage account with some stock broker, and that would not be treated as being removed from the TSP. It would still be considered part of the TSP. And that brokerage account will have about 5,000 funds available for people to purchase. And I was very surprised by this. Now, I did you know, a little bit of research, and I found out that they've actually been talking about it, Mike, since 2008. If you look at the board minutes,
it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. To me, it runs so counter to what the TSP is trying to do in other ways. One, it allows people to take money out of the regular TSP funds, and they may limit the amount, but we don't know that yet. It becomes so much more complicated for people who do that, because instead of having 15 funds to choose among, they'll have 5,015.
Yeah.
And that's going to include a lot of choices that it might be tempting for people to make that, you know, in the end don't work out, like investing in gold and alternative investments and alternative types of bond and Chinese funds. I don't know if Congress will let them do that, but anyway, it will, however, allow people to invest in what are called ESG funds, which are funds that sort through and try and find companies that score high in terms of their commitment to doing things that are good for the environment, in goods that are good for society at large, that treat their employees well, things like that. That's a positive, but it's much more complicated. I would think it would be more expensive for the TSP to manage, but from what I've seen written, you know, in the board minutes, all I've been able to find is that, yeah, there are going to be some costs to set it up, but I haven't seen any estimate of whether future costs will be higher. But it's, I think it's pretty clear that the funds that will be available for people to invest in will have higher costs, and there may be costs to buy and sell too. And it's going to encourage salespeople, for instance, you know, maybe a fund that invests in gold, to then target, you know, TSP investors and start advertising to them and trying to convince them to get into that. And it will allow those investors to take much greater risks and things that I, you know, in many cases, things that I would not recommend to my clients, but that are available out there. So I was surprised, but it's going to happen. I saw a couple of, apparently there are lots of 401ks, not on a percentage basis, but there are a lot of 401ks that do offer this to their employees. Typically, a very small number of people, like 1-4%, take advantage of it. And I don't know if that would be different with TSP or not.
Well, one of the things that intrigues me is when they set up the Thrift Savings Plan, it was bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats both, and the rule was KISS, K-I-S, keep it simple. And they wanted to keep it simple because they'd keep the cost down. And for many, many years, decades even, the TSP had the lowest administrative fees in the financial markets. Now, there are a couple of funds that are slightly less now, but not many. And the other thing is, once they set it up and it vowed to keep it simple, then there was this tremendous political pressure from both the Republicans and the Democrats to let new funds into it, because obviously there's a lot of money to be made for the brokers and the companies themselves. And they wanted to have socially conscious funds and you know, as you mentioned, environmentally safe funds and all that. And a lot of people think that many people lost sight of what the TSP is, and it is an investment vehicle, but it's also an adjunct to your retirement. And it's part of, for FERS employees, it's the third leg of retirement, along with a reduced government annuity and Social Security. For CSRS people, it's gravy. They don't get the 5% match, but it's still part of their retirement package. And to have it go into something socially conscious. I mean, a Save the Whales Fund would be wonderful, and I'm sure there are that, but I'm not sure you would want to put your retirement money in it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's just one of the reasons the TSP has been so successful and popular is there aren't many choices.
Yep.
And, you know, if they had, and I'm talking about the traditional funds, maybe one additional bond fund, and they really don't need much more. Mm-hmm. Because it's simple, it's easy for people to make decisions. It's easier. And, you know, lots of studies, the more choices you give people, the more difficult it is for them to make decisions. And in many cases, then they just don't make a decision because they might be brilliant and, you know, PhD in math and are an engineer, but that doesn't mean that they have the background to make, you know, investment decisions and the knowledge. So once we get to, you know, oh, here are 5,000 funds you can invest in, I don't think it'll be pretty.
Yes. You know? Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, the thing too, it's such an emotional thing. You know, you were talking about the people who said the market was going to go down when President Trump was elected, and it didn't. But Eric wants us to take a break here, so let's do that. And we'll resume here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM, just a minute. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. We're in the final countdown here, talking with Arthur Stein, financial planner in the Washington area. Art, one more time, how do people get in touch with you?
So the website is ArthurSteinFinancial.com, ArthurStein Financial.com. My email address is art@ArthurSteinFinancial.com.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to hear from any of your listeners.
Great, great, okay. And we got a question here from somebody who obviously read the column you wrote today. And he says, does your guest agree that the stock market rally doesn't happen without the intervention of the Federal Reserve? Secondly, what happens to the stock market if the Fed decides to aggressively raise interest rates to combat runaway inflation? Good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. And, you know, I did mention it in the article today. Why is the market doing so well? And here's another question. Why did the market do so well in 2020? When we had this terrible COVID thing and, you know, we had not started really heavily vaccinating people at the end of 2020. And the market, you know, the C and the S funds did great. And so did the I fund. So why is that? Well, one, no one knows for sure. So let me just put that out.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons is interest rates are extremely low. And another reason is that the Federal Reserve, you know, which manages the monetary policy for the United States, did something called quantitative easing. And that's when they buy long-term bonds in huge amounts. And there are two results from that, which is that one, it puts a lot of dollars into the economy, and more currency, more dollars into the economy is good for the economy, you know.
Yeah, people spend. And,
the second thing is it lowers long-term interest rates, and they did this very aggressively. Now, and they continue to do it. They're still doing it. So, the question that comes up, what happens when they stop doing it? And actually, you know, they've done this before, most notably in 2007, 8, and 9 during that recession and crash. And what we found was when they cut back, it did not, the stock markets did not crash. You know, they kind of anticipated it. So it's very mixed. Of course, other things were that besides low interest rates was just that, you know, once people saw that there were going to be vaccines, and then they kind of anticipated that the economy would get better. And the U.S. stock market's what's called a leading indicator. It tends to go up before the economy starts getting better.
Well, what interests me always, particularly when you get into day trading, is the emotion that's involved in this. And if you've got to remove that. And I know John Bogle, the founder of the Vanguard, the index fund, the father, he said on this very program one time, he said, I can't time the market, and I don't know anybody that can, and which coming from him is pretty interesting. And Warren Buffett has said the same thing, that timing the market just does not work. And I was thinking in mid-July here in the Washington area, and I guess most of the East Coast, we've had some kind of nasty, smoky, cloudy skies, and that comes from the forest fires in Oregon, you know, long way away. But it's having an impact here. And I remember possibly 10 years ago when, you know, out of the blue, a volcano erupted in Iceland, and it created so much turbulence in the air and that traffic in the North Atlantic, air traffic was interfered with for several months. And, you know, you can't predict things like that.
Exactly. Warren Buffett's a very good example because he's considered maybe the most successful investor in history. And by investor, I mean that he bought and sold individual companies mm-hmm. and the stocks of individual companies. And so it's not a buy and hold in an index, you know, which is what we've been speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did that, when he was getting ready to buy or sell a company, he would do an enormous amount of research. But one thing he never took into account was whether the stock market was high or low, and whether taxes were higher or lower than people thought they should be. He just looked at the individual companies. Was there value there? Was the stock price of that company, did that make it a good deal? I would not suggest that individual investors do that. But I would say that stock market, it's a long-term investment. And if you're in it for the long term, historically it didn't make a difference whether you would do well, whether you had started investing when the market was up or when it was down. It just, how long did you have to patiently wait for your investment to increase in value?
Right. And again, this is you're investing for retirement. It's not a sport. It's not a bar or a betting thing. This is investing for the long haul for retirement. But anyway, I appreciate it, Arthur Stein. Thank you for being the guest today.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Eric White, for producing the show. We hope to see you all here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week and stay safe.
You've been listening to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at weepa.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. And during his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the President and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970, and then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy. With six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything. And it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired, after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more, because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Seed to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life, and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual, and that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career. But really, it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you used to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was, you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From Sea to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. When I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories as parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And my wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me. And I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons and in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gained the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect, thank you. Yeah, WAPA serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the US Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler. And to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast, we'll see you next time.